Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast.
Good afternoon. This is Beth Warner. I'm joined for a conversation today with Adjunct Professor of Music Research at McGill University, John Roston. Thanks for joining us today, John.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
So could you tell us a little bit about open orchestra and what that involves?
Open orchestra is actually a simulator, and we happen to be using it in music, but we're hoping it could also be applied to other subject areas. And essentially, it's a large three-screen display, so a panoramic display, a center screen and one on the left and one on the right, that is designed to give you the feeling that you're somewhere else. And in the case of open orchestra, what we're trying to give you the feeling of is playing in an orchestra. Or we also have an opera version, so it may be a situation where you're a singer in an opera. And what we're trying to show you is what you would see if you were on stage and either sitting in the orchestra or singing in the opera, while you're actually, in fact, in a small audio practice room in the music faculty. And you're there by yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we're trying to make very realistic, and the side screens are sort of angled to try to stimulate your peripheral vision and try to make it a very involving experience.
Mm-hmm. Ah. Do you also have a view for the conductor as well?
Yes, we do, and that was actually came about accidentally. It was when we first started recording, and we've recorded a jazz band, we've also recorded a classical opera, and we've recorded a classical ensemble. And we record from the point of view of six individual musicians or opera singers. Mm-hmm. And it was only when we actually recorded them and realized that the musicians don't see everybody they're playing with. They only see the conductor and the people who are sort of immediately adjacent to them. Mm-hmm. And we realized that because it's sort of a virtual orchestra, they wouldn't have any idea of what the whole looked like. So mm-hmm. they wouldn't sort of see their place in the whole. So we then luckily caught it in time and did a recording from the conductor's point of view. And that's what that's what the student sees first. So the student sees, this is the group, here's what it looks like from the conductor's position, and then you're going to replace that musician there. And then we switch it around, and you see what that person sees.
So can you tell us a little bit about how McGill plans to use open orchestra, maybe a case scenario of their approach?
So what happened before is that a student would practice alone and then go and practice in the orchestra. And this new thing, open orchestra, this experience is inserted in the middle. So they still go and practice on their own. Mm-hmm. Then they come and try to play using the open orchestra system to play sort of virtually as part of an orchestra. And then they go and actually play with a real orchestra. Nice. So it doesn't replace anything that's happened in teaching. It's really something new. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our focus has been on whether students, first of all, feel it's helpful to them. Mm-hmm. And there isn't really a way of measuring whether actually their performance is much better. We can sort of get anecdotal evidence from the conductor. Mm-hmm. But there's no way of knowing objectively whether it really improves teaching. But it is very important to know how the students feel and whether they feel it's improved their teaching. And there the feedback has been extremely positive. And we also found out that they just love using it.
So could you tell us a little bit about the background and the current status of the Teaching Space Working Group, and how does it impact teaching and learning at McGill?
Be glad to. The Teaching and Learning Space Working Group began in 2006. And I was, at the time, director of McGill's department that was concerned with the use of technology in teaching. And my counterpart, Cynthia Weston, was chair of Teaching and Learning Services. So this is the academic group which is really charged with helping professors improve their teaching. And the two of us got together, and with the university's collaboration, we formed this group that would look at how teaching spaces are created, how they're renovated, how existing ones are renovated, and how they're funded. And the funding model in the past had been that classrooms were seen as kind of belonging to the faculty where they were located. Mm-hmm. Not only that, any money that went into creating new ones or renovating existing ones was part of the regular budgetary process. So when the dean negotiated his or her annual budget, this was just another element of the budget. And it was allocated more or less according to the size of the faculty. So very large faculties got very large, what we call capital money allocations for teaching spaces, and very small faculties, like we have a very small faculty of religious studies at McGill, could probably never afford to renovate a single classroom due to their enrollment. So what this did is it changed the whole process by saying, firstly, all classrooms are owned centrally. The university owns them. Faculties where these teaching spaces are located would have a priority on occupying them, but they would be booked centrally. So in other words, they get to book them first, but any time they're not using, anybody else in the university who wants to teach there could book them and teach there. And secondly, that all of the funding would be centralized with this teaching and learning space working group. So this group would be given all the money. So it was, at the time, about $2 million, which is probably about average in most universities of McGill's size. It's actually been quite a success since then, and this year they've just announced they're going to double it to $4 million, so they seem to think it's working. But the principle was, because you can imagine that the deans who had been given this money to do with as they wished were not thrilled with the new arrangement. The idea was that each faculty would have two representatives on this working group. And one would be an academic person, so somebody in the faculty who is keen on teaching spaces and how they're designed and equipped. And one, usually a more technical person in the faculty. So there were two representatives from each faculty, and then representatives, aside from Cynthia and myself from our two departments, also people from the facility services who actually are in the construction business and do the actual building of spaces and renovating. And we rather thought, when the process began, that it would be a bit of a tug of war, and that it would be each faculty rep would really be really out to get as big a slice of the pie as possible. Mm-hmm. And much to our surprise, that's not how it worked at all. And it turned out that people were very interested in exactly what other faculties wanted to do. They were very interested in talking about things from the entire university's point of view. So, for example, what kind of new technology might there be that we would like to see adopted across the university? Mm-hmm. And they had a huge amount of input into that. And the fact that the committee might recommend that in the coming year we put a particular focus on this type of technology worked out extremely well, because then when each faculty came up with their list of priorities for what they would like to see done in specific rooms that their faculty use a lot, they could orient it with the notion that they already knew and they had participated in the decision that there was going to be an emphasis on trying to use a particular type of technology, whether it be a new type of projector or a different sort of arrangement of seating or whatever it might be. And we also found we could get economies of scale. So if, for example, we were placing seating in a number of different rooms all in the same year, we could negotiate a very good contract with the seating people. Mm-hmm. So, and the other part of it was, if they weren't getting money, they knew why, and they had participated and commented on that decision. And so, in a word, it was transparency.
So did you also find that it made an impact on how the faculty were able to support those classrooms then in terms of any shared training?
Yes.
Consistent equipment?
Exactly. So consistent equipment. So if you walked into a classroom, you knew exactly how it worked. The committee also set up online training. So if you're going to teach in a particular room, you can see that room from, you know, pictures taken from every conceivable angle, and showing you all the equipment. And then you can click on a picture and it gives you all the instructions for using a particular piece of equipment. And then there are actual in-room demonstrations scheduled every year for people who feel that actually like to come in and try it with a technician there. And of course, there's been a huge emphasis on making teaching interactive. So on designing the spaces so that rather than someone up on a podium at the front and everybody lower down in the seats facing them, that the podium could actually be in a number of different positions in the room, and it's a more group-like setting, and the students, rather than being in rows, are usually in groups, seated in groups so that they can talk to one another. Even in very large theaters where the seats are traditional theater seats, on each level, so assuming the seats are tiered in a large auditorium, the tiers are wide enough so that two rows are actually on the same level. And the front row seats can actually rotate around so that the students in the front row and the first row of seats can talk to the students in the second row of seats if the professor comes up with a topic of conversation and there's sort of a general class discussion. So there's a lot of interactive types of learning going on, even in quite large classes where traditionally this is not really possible. And one of the things that the committee has been doing is visiting a lot of other universities who are even better at it and studying what they've been doing and trying to implement best practices.
So, John, the final question. What direction do you see music technology moving in the future?
That's always the fascinating question. And as everybody knows from the music industry and the really dramatic changes that have taken place over the last decade in that there are going to be huge differences. In our particular research, we're interested not only in the fact that it's become much easier for anybody to publish music and make it available very, very widely, and everybody does that now. It's also the notion in terms of how things will move electronically. So we're looking beyond, synthesizers, where somebody plays a synthesizer and can make it sound like any other instrument they want and so on. But basically, you have a human involved in creating the notes. And instead, working with what we call synthetic orchestration, which is we have, for every instrument, every possible note recorded in a library, and every way that note can sort of be played. And then what we do is we string them all together so that we come up with an entire orchestra playing a work. Nobody has played any instrument at all. It's all just been strung together from libraries of notes. Mm-hmm. And actually, as part of a talk I'm being given at EDUCAUSE 2012, I'll be playing a little sequence of that where you just see the conductor, but you hear the full orchestra playing, and it's remarkably good. It's not. I don't think most of us would feel it has quite the color and the emotion that we would get from a real orchestra, and where you would really feel it makes a difference who's conducting it.
Sure.
But we may get there eventually, and it's very interesting to think in terms of music being created without actually playing any instruments.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Thank you very much for your time today. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just to thank you so much and to compliment EDUCAUSE on the valuable work they're doing, and we all appreciate it.
Great. We appreciate that. So thank you very much.